The Bloodstream podcast is made possible by Takeda and is intended for informational, educational, and entertainment purposes only. Please consult with professionals before making any healthcare decisions.
Normally, it's a very misdiagnosed type of disease. And he said, if you had gone to that game, you probably would have died on the court and everybody would have said you had a stroke or a heart attack.
That voice belongs to Jim Fenerty, the legendary basketball coach of Germantown Academy in Pennsylvania, who also lives with a rare blood cancer, polycythemia vera, or PV. He joins me later in the show to talk more about his illustrious career, his unfortunate diagnosis, and the campaign he's participating in to raise awareness and education for rare blood cancers. That conversation will follow my interview of Lisa Sarfati, the Director of Strategic Planning and Project Development for NORD, the National Organization for Rare Disorders. She joins me here shortly to talk primarily about NORD's Rare Impact Awards taking place on Friday, October 9th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Visit rarediseases.org to learn more. And now, having said all of that, let me next say hello and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast. I am host Patrick James Lynch, joined in the virtual booth by none other than the only Broncos fan I know, Amy Board. Hello, Amy. How are you?
And I will fill up that space for you, that Denver Bronco space.
How are you feeling so far, a couple games into the season?
Not great. Not great. We are it's tragic this year. It's extremely tragic. I think we have so many injuries. It's insane. Our first big injury was Von Miller, who basically carries our team. He's out for the season with an ankle. And then quarterback went down, and I spoke to my mom about it. My entire family it's seeped into our blood. And my mom was like, maybe when you move to California, like, you'll become a Rams fan. And I was like, maybe. And then, like, as this season has progressed, like, even though we're so terrible, it's like, no, this is in my blood. I will be a Denver Bronco fan till I die, including this terrible season. And our GM, of course, is Denver Bronco legend John Elway, and we think this is the year he's going to get canned. We honestly do. It's that
Does
bad.
Does ownership have the stones to can John Elway?
I don't know. Ooh. I don't know, but I don't think he's done a good job.
But he also did win a Super Bowl in the last like 6 or 7 years, right? The Peyton Manning.
Yes. And you know, and to tell you the truth, like, he was instrumental in Peyton Manning because John Elway won his Super Bowls when he was ancient, you know, ancient being like my age right now, in football years. But he was just instrumental at courting Peyton. Like, we're going to do this. We're going to build this team around you and you can have like these last years, which is great. And John Elway has built an incredible defense, and he just hasn't been able to find that young quarterback hotshot, and he's had several opportunities to do it. And now we have Kansas City with freaking Patrick Mahomes, and it's just going to be a decade of sorrow.
Problem. Yeah, it's going to be a problem for you guys. I mean, as I don't follow too much football these days, but as a Jets fan, I mean, just having to live through 2 decades of Tom Brady and the Patriots, I mean, if it's going to be anything like that, Good luck to you, your mom, and your family.
Thank you. Actually, and speaking of this week, we are playing the Jets, and like Twitter is just a buzz with like, you know,
where's Tim Tebow?
Yeah, and everyone's like, oh, hats off to the poor, you know, social media kid that has to like find highlights of like the Broncos and the Jets.
No kidding.
To like put into an ad. So anyway.
Well, other than football coming back and basketball moving into the finals, which I'm psyched about, we also had something of a quote-unquote debate this week. But there's plenty of people talking about that. I don't think we need to, but my goodness, what a... But we do want to talk a little bit about one important topic as it relates to politics and government, and that's voting, right?
Yeah. I think, you know... I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel... And it's a civic duty that I feel very, you know, I've always enjoyed. And that's been a thing my family, my parents very much have always instilled the joy of voting. And they've always encouraged it, which is great. It's been a family thing. However, I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel totally peer pressured by celebrities on social media to vote. I mean, like...
Are you not planning to?
No, I totally am, but I am nervous this year. I am like there, and of course, there's a lot of things percolating about this election and all these things. But like, see, and it's been that way for a while. But I feel very peer pressured by celebrities. Like, if Taylor Swift tells me to vote, like, okay, like better vote. So I'm sure some of our listeners are like, great, yeah. But it is confusing. So we just wanted to take a minute. It's 32 days left to this election, which kind of like blows my mind. But, you know, I think with voting, something that has been tricky, and it's also been tricky moving into a new state in this election, is, you know, I have always voted in Colorado. And so there's just been kind of this, I've never worried about it. And this year it's just been kind of new. And just to reiterate to everybody out there that each state has their voting guidelines. So there is no overarching date of when, you know, early voting happens and, you know, starts and begins. There's no overarching date of, you know, absentee ballot. You know, some have certain dates, some don't. In some dates, you can still register to vote. Like in California, you can actually go on registration day, or voting day rather, election day. Third time's a charm. So on November 3rd, if you go in person to vote, you can actually register that day and vote. That's not the same in every state. So there are tremendous resources for everybody as like one central hub. My favorite that is just really comprehensive and wonderful is vote.org. Again, it's vote.org. And they have everything. You can actually check your registration. You can see if you can vote by mail. You can get election reminders, which is great. Another thing that's wonderful is you can find polling place locations. So if you're kind of wondering, where do I go? Where's a drop-off location? Do I mail my ballot in? Am I even going to get a mail ballot? Is that a thing? Because it's not a thing in every state. You can find that out. And it has links to every single state, their election deadlines, the dates and the rules for every state. And then they also link to the Secretary of State in your state. And again, that is the office that is in charge of the election in each state, is the Secretary of State. So that's where you're going to want to go. And, you know, it's just, it feels like almost a stressful thing, and this year, I'm just going to speak for myself, almost the joy is being taken out of it. I mean, it just feels very stressful, but every state is so different and so, I mean, there are certain states that you have to have the ballot postmarked by November 3rd, and there are certain states that you have to have it like in, like it has to be mailed and in someone's hands by November 2nd at 5 p.m., so it's just good to check with your state, and there are just tremendous resources. Vote.com or vote.org, oh my gosh, is the one that I like. And then there's another one that actually is doing a great social media campaign, whenweallvote.org, which is a nonprofit kind of spearheaded by Michelle Obama, actually. But that's another good resource as well.
Whenweallvote.org?
Whenweallvote.org. We've got 32 days. 32
Wow. Days. Yes. And also take the time to look into your local elections and your local officials. You know, I know for Natalie and I, we've been getting so much mail to the house from different campaigns, and, you know, we'll do what we've done in years past, which is choose a night in the next couple of weeks where we sit down and we just Google all the names and we look up what they've said about stuff. And, you know, try to Amy's point, we try to bring the joy back into voting by sitting down, open, well, she's pregnant and I don't drink, but we'll open a bottle of wine just because, you know, it's part of the ceremony and we'll put it over there. And then just go through the names of the candidates and find the people who line up with the priorities that you have in your household.
And this happens in Colorado, and I don't, again, this is like my first year. I don't know on Colorado rules, but Colorado sends every election, even primaries and things, they send a booklet with the ballot. So everyone in Colorado gets a mail-in ballot regardless. So you can take your ballot, and which is tremendous and should be a thing. But they give you this booklet, and not only do they kind of go through candidates, but they also go through all the different propositions, all the different budget cut items and things, and they give like pros and cons. So you can read that booklet and be informed like, oh, this, you know, school tax will do X, Y, and Z, X, Y, and Z, and then you can, you know, kind of read, you know, go to another resource to read more. Do other states do that? Does California do that?
Yeah, California does, and like the booklet that gets sent around, though, is, my recollection is like it's a little sensational. I don't know who does the copywriting, but like even the pros and cons list is just a little spinny, so it's like it kind of all sounds like it could be anything on some level.
Oh.
So I definitely agree with what you said there at the end, that you do some Googling and get some additional background, because those, at least in California, those booklets are only part of the story.
That's actually great, because Colorado doesn't feel that way. It feels policy language, and it's also one of those things where it's like, oh, because if you've been in a policy world at all, you kind of understand, you start to understand like the language and like the OIC back and forth of systems. But if you're not a part of that, it's kind of like, I don't know what this means. So that's interesting.
I guess there's pros and cons to each of those two approaches as well. So vote.org, whenweallvote.org, vote, tell your friends to vote. And again, look into your local officials and make sure that you are using the power of your vote to try to make change both nationally and locally. So we do have a couple conversations to get to. As mentioned earlier, Jim Fennerty, legendary coach of Germantown Academy in Pennsylvania, Lisa Safferty, director of strategic planning and project development at NORD, coming up here in just a moment. But first, I did want to mention we have a screening taking place of Let's Talk, Believe Limited's new mental health documentary that we created in collaboration with Mental Health Matters 2 and is supported by Sanofi Genzyme. We're doing a screening open to all on World Mental Health Day. That's October 10th, and that will be at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard, 4 p.m. Pacific. We've got a really awesome panel that includes people from The Mighty, The Courageous Parents Network, and the Disorder Rare Disease Film Festival. So I highly recommend, if you're interested, there's a link in the program notes. It'll be streaming live on Facebook. Again, that's October 10th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard. You can go to letstalkmh.com for more, or again, follow the link in the program notes. And now with that, we will get to my interview with Lisa Safferty from NORD. For the first time ever, NORD will present the 2020 Rare Impact Awards as an exclusive online event on October 9th. NORD looks forward to celebrating the individuals, groups, and companies making extraordinary contributions to the lives of rare disease patients and caregivers. Alone, we are rare. Together, we are strong. Honorees include fellow hemophilia advocate and state representative Randy Cleetes, the Honorable Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, Peter Frampton, music legend and patient advocate with the Myostasis Association, and me, amongst others. Yeah, I snuck in there somehow. The program will also include behind-the-scenes footage and a song from the original musical, Hemophilia the Zoomsicle, plus an appearance and some kind words from hemophilia and bleeding disorders advocate Alex Borstein. So some strong bleeder representation. And it all goes down Friday, October 9th, from 7 to 8:30 Eastern Standard. That's 4 to 5:30 Pacific for my fellow West Coasters. It is free to attend, but registration is required. You can visit rarediseases.org/rare-impact-awards, or follow the link in the program notes to register. And to chat with us a bit about the Rare Impact Awards, NORD, and rare disease in general, is Lisa Safferty, Director of Strategic Planning and Project Development, who joins me right now. Hello, Lisa, and welcome to Bloodstream.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So we are a little more than a week out from the Rare Impact Awards. So I know from producing events, there are probably a number of elements that are front and center on NORD's mind right now. So other than promotion, which I can see you are doing, what else does NORD have going on in the run-up to the Rare Impact Awards right now?
There's so much going on right now as we go into that final push for getting the event off the ground. It's truly an all-staff event. So everyone from our events team to the marketing team, membership, I mean, everyone is just cranking out as much as they can to support this program. I've been involved in it for the last 9 years. And so this is the first time the entire program has been virtual. So it's going to be really interesting. I'm really impressed with how the team is pulling this off. There's so many nuances that people don't realize go into it. Like creating a dynamic script to make sure that there's that level of engagement that you would normally have on stage.
Right.
as well as engaging with your attendees that are now virtual, you don't get that same feedback from a crowd. You're not seeing their reaction to things. So you have to really build in opportunities to engage them in the program and make sure that they are enjoying themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Rare Impact Awards, again, taking place on October 9th, 7 to 8:30 Eastern, link in the program notes. But I want to zoom out for a moment, Lisa. You just mentioned how long you've been with NORD. Your current title, Director of Strategic Planning and Project Development. You've had a number of additional titles while you've been there. You have a BA in Poli-Sci from Baruch, shout out to the CUNY system, a Master's in Public Health in Health Policy from George Washington University, and you were a fellow at the U.S. Health and Human Services. You started working with NORD, in fact, before your graduate work was even complete. So that all leads me to ask, when did you know that rare disease advocacy was going to be your professional focus, and why is it?
That's a good question. And I actually had to think about that because I don't know if I've reflected on that over the last 9 years. But I would have to say it was after my internship with NORD ended. I actually thought that NORD was going to be a blip on my career timeline. I was studying to go into emergency preparedness and biodefense. That was what I was interested in. And so it's a completely different field. But I needed an internship credit. And so NORD posted a job and I decided I'd do it and figured I'd only stick around for a few months. A few months turned into a year, which then turned into 2 years. And when I was getting ready to leave and move back to New York, where I grew up, and pursue what I had studied, Peter, our CEO, basically said to me, "Yeah, we're not letting you go," and presented a job opportunity that I just couldn't pass up. And I'd have to say that first year of being the director of membership really, I think, is when I realized that I can't do anything else now. You can't work in rare diseases and then go do something else, because it is so interesting. There's so much happening in the field, especially over the last decade. And you just become so passionate. You meet these families and you just can't imagine getting that interested and excited to go to work every day in any other field.
So to jump off of that, you've been there for these 9 years. You've seen, as you just suggested, a lot take place in this past decade. From where you are now, what has been the most significant evolution or point of growth within NORD across this past decade?
So much has changed at NORD, to be honest. In some ways, it's like a completely different organization than when I first started. The mission is still the same and the drive and the passion, but we've really evolved in so many areas. Our policy work has truly evolved and grown, especially with the Affordable Care Act and now going and working on the state level. But I guess if I had to pick out the one point of growth that I think is the most substantial, it would probably be our research program. When I first started at NORD, we had a research grant program that provided seed funding. And I mean, it was a really great program, had been ongoing for I think over 30 years at that point, or close to. But in the last 9 years, we developed a registry program, which provides a platform for natural history studies for rare diseases. And that has been a really big endeavor, and really took us into a new direction with research and allowed us to support patient organizations and patients directly and not just be a funder or distributor of funds for research. And I think that's probably been the most significant area of growth that I've seen in the organization.
Interesting. Now, from the work that you've been a part of personally, something that stood out to me that I'd love to hear you speak a little bit more about is what became known as the Rare Action Network. Can you share a little bit about what the Rare Action Network is and perhaps how it has grown since its inception?
Of course. I love talking about this program. It's interesting. I think back to sitting in a small conference room with our CEO and our at the time, our chief of operations, and you know, the Affordable Care Act was about to be implemented, and this was really going to change the way that NORD did policy work, as I mentioned earlier. And we now had to think about working at the state level, which isn't something that we had really done a lot of at that time, because everything was happening federally. So, I mean, we were sitting in this conference room for hours and trying to think of, you know, what would be the best way to mobilize patients, and really work with them to understand, you know, what they needed to know and what changes were going to be happening in their states, because there was going to be so many differences, right, between one state to another. So we came up with this idea to build this network of advocates across the country that we could educate on what the biggest issues were that were happening in the rare disease space, things that were happening in their specific state, work with them to also understand what was happening, boots on the ground, give them training on how to successfully advocate for rare diseases with your policymakers, but also with your public health departments and whomever else, depending on the issue. And so what started off as, you know, just three of us in a conference room, not sure if it was going to take off, not sure how much work was going to be involved, has significantly grown to where we have, I think, 16,000 people that now participate in the program that take action whenever we put out calls, whether it's for, you know, email your representative and or, you know, make this phone call. It's really important and time sensitive. And so it's been really impactful, I think, across the states that we've been working in. We have 57 state ambassadors working in 37 states. And we've had nearly 6,000 actions taken over the last few years Wow. alone. So I think it really speaks to the volume and the level of engagement that we have. So I'm really proud of that program. I think it's just grown tremendously. It's under a different team from when we first created it. And I'm really excited to see how it continues to grow and evolve and impact the lives of patients.
You know, Lisa, one of the things in healthcare that is on the brink of changing is the introduction of gene therapy in a large way. There are already some gene therapy products that have reached the commercial market, but we know that this is only going to increase, and the impact on rare disease patients and families stands to be something quite interesting. Gene therapy is very exciting, it's very complex, and it's disruptive, so to speak. So I'm curious to know, from your perspective as a strategist, how do you think gene therapy is going to influence NORD's work and the way we consider healthcare within the rare disease community over the next 5 to 10 years here in the U.S.?
I mean, gene therapy, I mean, it's so promising, especially for rare diseases, especially considering that 80 to 85% of rare diseases are genetic. And it's influenced our work a lot, even over the last few years, with the recent approvals, but also the fact that there are hundreds of programs now underway for gene therapy. So it's very exciting. You know, once that first approval came through, we started getting an influx of emails and calls from the patient community asking us about gene therapy and whether they would have access to it. And we quickly realized that there is a huge gap of understanding about what is gene therapy, how does it work, whether or not specific diseases could benefit from a gene therapy, and what programs were underway. And so we quickly had to mobilize a program around this to make sure that we were providing patients and families with some of these basic foundational resources and pieces of education. So that wasn't something that we were proactively, I would say, working on before mm-hmm. then. I think gene therapy was always there, right? And we knew it was coming, but the speed and the pace, I'd say, at which it's really picked up has been amazing, jaw-dropping in some ways, I think, at least from my perspective. So I think it's influenced what we do greatly. And I think it's something that we're paying very close attention to see how it changes. Obviously, it sparked a lot of conversation in the community about access and pricing. And, you know, NORD is always of the position that we want to make sure that patients have access to these transformative therapies and drugs that are approved and on the market. So I think that's something that we're going to pay close attention to. And I think that's going to have a big impact on the future of rare disease treatments.
Are there any concerns about expectations of patients and families as it relates to gene therapy or gene therapy clinical trials?
I think so. You know, from my perspective, I think that patients have a lot riding on this, and they have a lot of hope built into this idea of a cure. I think that's the gold at the end of the rainbow for every patient, right, in their journey. You want a cure. You want a treatment at the very least, but a cure is what everyone is looking for. And so when you hear about these gene therapies, I think a lot of patients are really setting high expectations for what this may mean for them and for their loved ones and for the community that they've built around them. I think that natural history studies are going to be really important for monitoring these gene therapies and ensuring that they deliver upon the promise. So I think that that's something that I'll be looking forward to seeing the data and just knowing whether or not they are truly providing cures for the patients that are, like I said, really relying on them.
I'm speaking with Lisa Safferty, the Director of Strategic Planning and Project Development at NORD. NORD, of course, has the Rare Impact Awards, the first time it will be fully virtual, taking place this October 9th, 7 to 8:30 Eastern Standard. Links in the program notes. Lisa, is there anything that NORD has learned from this virtual, innovative, adaptation-heavy 2020 that will not only help the Rare Impact Awards, but will help NORD pursue its mission just better in 2021 and beyond?
Of course. I think every day we're learning something new. We worked in a remote-like setting before 2020 because we're spread out across three offices. So we were pretty used to working remotely. I think obviously it's been a huge change to take everything you do and now turn into a remote program. In an interesting way, though, the one thing that I think we're picking up on and learning the most from is a little bit ironic, given the fact that everything has gone virtual. It's really made us hypersensitive, or I'd say hyper aware, of the fact that so many patients and families have always been unable to travel to events in person.
Right.
But they also lack the technology to participate even in a virtual setting. And I think as we are in the 21st century, there's such a reliance on technology and this natural assumption that it's readily available and that people are utilizing it. And I think in a strange way, 2020 has really brought this into the forefront for us to say, we need to go back almost, right, in time and use more direct communication strategies to reach patients where they are with the resources that they have available to them. So whether that's working with community health centers or doing more direct mail instead of email, like I said, it's strange, right? Because we're in a remote world now and everyone's on Zoom all the time and relying on email and their phones. But really, I think for us, it's going back to ensuring that we can deliver our mission to as many patients as possible. And the only way to do that is to really, like I said, meet patients where they are with what they have access to.
Is there anything that you wish people better understood about NORD's work?
Probably a lot of things. When you work in an organization for 9 years, I think there's so much that you know about the organization that you work for and the people that you work with, and you just wish that everyone could see and hear what you do.
Sure.
I would say one of the biggest challenges that we have is the fact that we have to communicate to so many different stakeholders. And if there was anything that I wish people understood more than they do, it's probably that we're not as big of an organization as I think people think we are. You read our 990, or you hear that we have 75 employees, for example, and you just assume this very large organization. And I think that's a common misconception about us. A third of our staff actually work in a call center, so they are answering patient phone calls and emails all day long, and really trying to support patients in their journey to getting access to financial services. Or research that they want to participate in. And so our program teams are actually relatively small, I would say, small but mighty in doing a lot of work. So I think that's a common misconception. And I also think from a fundraising perspective, when you run a patient assistance program, a lot of that funding comes in, those donations, and then they go right back
right
out to the patients. So I think if people could, you know, take a peek behind the camera at NORD, they would see that we're actually, you know, a much smaller, more intimate organization than I think the perception has been.
Yeah, that's interesting to know that a third are people in call centers speaking directly to patients and families. I mean, that's excellent, but also it does put into context, greater context, the actual number of employees and what their responsibilities are and how many responsibilities each, I'm sure, have. We are almost out of time, so let me bring us back to the Rare Impact Awards. Again, coming up October 9th, a link in the program notes to register and attend for free. What are you most looking forward to in this year's program? And what's so important about the Rare Impact Awards for NORD? Why have them?
I think the awards are important because it's a chance to take a step back and truly reflect as a community about all the positive achievements that we're realizing. We're so focused day in and day out on the hard, gritty work that needs to be done. You don't always get that opportunity to come up and celebrate those successes. I think it's really great to shine a spotlight on individuals who are making these changes. There's 30 million Americans on average, I believe, in the US with the rare disease at this point. So there's so many people who are just not getting recognized for the work that they're doing. And so I think it's a really great opportunity to recognize them for their hard work, inspire others in the community to either get involved or more involved, but also recognize that every day you may not see the impact that your work is having, but it's there. And so I think the Rare Impact Awards are just really special for that reason, because I really enjoy hearing about the honorees. Even this year, I'm so looking forward to their stories. It always brings tears to my eye, but in a positive way, because it's inspiring. Sure. And I think this year, with everything 2020 has thrown us, we need that. Yeah. We need to be inspired. We need uplifting stories. We need to be reminded that we are a community that supports one another more now probably than ever before, I'd say.
Yes, I agree with you on that, very much so. So, all right, lastly, and Lisa, thank you so much for the time today. I'm going to allow you now to pull out your make-believe magic wand. And if there was one thing with your make-believe magic wand about the way rare disease care is delivered and managed in the United States, what would that magic wand waving accomplish?
I think the wand would provide every patient with a diagnosis, a timely and accurate diagnosis. I think that's the hardest part for some patients in their journey, is not knowing. And we all know the longer you wait to get that diagnosis, the longer away you are from being on the appropriate treatment and care management plan. So if I had a magic wand tomorrow, I would give everyone an accurate and timely diagnosis so that we can work together as a community to ensure that they have access to the treatments and care that they need.
That is a fantastic answer. And it sounds like one that would come from the Director of Strategic Planning and Project Development, Lisa Sarfati at NORD. A reminder that NORD's hosting the Rare Impact Awards Friday, October 9th, 1 week from today, if you're listening in real time, at 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. And it will feature music legend Peter Frampton, Senator Sherrod Brown, the cast of Hemophilia the Zoomsicle, and many others. Again, October 9th, 7:30 Eastern Standard, free to all who register. And you can follow the link in the program notes or visit rarediseases.org for more. Lisa, thanks so much for joining and sharing some with me today. Good luck with the rest of the preparations coming up, and I'm very excited to see what the Rare Impact Awards have in store for us next week.
Thank you so much for having me, and I want to say congratulations on your nomination. I look forward to hearing your story as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
The presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast is Takeda. To learn more about Takeda's resources and the commitment that they have to the bleeding disorder community, visit bleedingdisorders.com. Once again,
what was that website, Amy? What was that website?
Oh, again, it's bleedingdisorders.com. And thank you, Takeda, for your support. This is a continued support and partnership, and we so appreciate it.
Thanks, Takeda.
Thanks, Takeda.
All right, joining me here in just a moment for the interview is an all-time great basketball coach from Germantown Academy in Pennsylvania, Jim Fennerty. So I'm in my element. But the reason he's coming on today is actually to talk about a chronic rare blood cancer that he has called polycythemia vera, or PV. PV is a part or one of many rare blood cancers that falls into a group called myeloproliferative neoplasms, or MPNs. And Jim participated in a new educational initiative sponsored by Insight that brings to life the powerful and personal stories of real people living with MPNs. In fact, it also has a series of portraits from an artist, J.G. Jones, who is a renowned comic book artist and an MPN patient for over a decade. And he uses art to bring to life the stories of these individuals impacted by MPNs, including Jim. September was Rare Blood Cancer Awareness Month, and for that reason, we decided to invite Jim here to talk a little bit about his experience as a patient and, of course, his experience as a legendary basketball coach. So here it is, my conversation with Jim Fennerty. You know, my wife grew up, I'm in Ohio right now, actually. I mentioned not being where I typically am, which is Los Angeles. I'm with family in Ohio. And my wife and I are the same age as LeBron, and she played on the girls' team here in South Euclid for a Brush. So when she would play on the girls' team and they would play the rival school, is it St. Mary, St. James? Probably have those, one of those directions. But yeah, she got to grow up watching him play too. And my father-in-law talks about watching him play in high school. And I just, like, what an experience that must be to have seen, and not just him, but for you, the number of athletes that you must have seen then go on. That's got to be such a treat.
Patrick, it really was. I mean, you know, I taught and coached at a great school, Germantown Academy in Fort Washington. It's a private school right outside of Philadelphia. And the kids there go because they want to go to good colleges. And the basketball players all wanted to play at good colleges. So we always played a pretty competitive schedule. And I mean, you know, we did play LeBron at Ohio University when he was a junior, and we did play Kobe Bryant. Actually, Kobe Bryant worked for me in camps during the summer. But we played against him in high school. And well, Kobe has the economic record for the biggest raise in the history of the world. He made $125 a week working for me when he was a junior. And at the end of his senior year, he made a little bit more than that from the NBA.
Yeah, not a bad curve and, there. Not a bad curve for him.
Not bad. And then we did play Kevin Durant. We've been very fortunate, but my guys that played for me, basically now, they always say they don't remember all the scores of the games, but they remember every experience, and that's what I was I was glad.
That's interesting. Can you expand on that? What do you mean when you say they remember the experience?
Flying out to Ohio to play at Ohio University because St. Vincent St. Mary's school was where LeBron played was too small for the number of people. And, you know, we played before a packed house and it wasn't anybody rooting for us other than my son, who was at that point the ball boy. But it was incredible. Playing Kobe Bryant, we did that at our place for charity. It was the Ronald McDonald House we did that. Our football coach's daughter was suffering cancer at that point. And so we donated the money there and Kobe on. I didn't get Kobe to come to my school, but we did play him. And, you know, we raised a lot of money for that. And then the kids, when we played up, we played in a lot of places. We played in Charleston. We played in San Antonio. We played in L.A. We played in Springfield, Mass. And they remember the experiences of meeting different people, doing a lot of things for charity, because we always believed that I didn't want them just to be basketball players. I wanted them to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And so that's, I was really happy when they do get reunions, you know, when I finally did retire, a lot of the kids came back and that's what they talked about. They talked about the crazy things that I did probably in practice or in games, but they also remembered like all the different trips that we went on and the different experiences that they played against. And now they're telling their kids, I covered LeBron. He didn't get, you know, I held him to 35. it's one of those things. But it was fun. It was a great experience. I'm very fortunate.
Did you know you always wanted a coach?
I kind of did. When I was in high school, I was just a decent player. And at the end of my sophomore year, my high school coach said, coaches sometimes are the breakers of dreams, but he kind of brought me aside and said, Jim, I know you love this game, but you're not that great a player. And I was at a very large high school, and he said, but here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to go and I want you to coach a summer team. And so he hooked me up with a CYO team, and that was it. I fell in love. I fell in love with coaching, and I've been coaching ever since, and I just finally had to retire in January of 2019. But I love the practices. I love the games. And I love just working with the guys and working with the kids. Because, you know, when I went to Germantown Academy, it's a private school, so you wind up doing everything. And before right. I became the athletic director, I wound up coaching girls softball, of which I knew very little, but I thoroughly enjoyed the kids. And so, you know, I think you can be a teacher in the classroom or you can be a teacher outside of the classroom. And I think I was a little bit of both, I hope.
You know, I remember very well I was in high school. So like you, I loved basketball, but as a kid with hemophilia and a lot of issues as a result, yeah. I was not able to play the way I wanted. So I was student manager. I did play-by-play for the communications club. I did all the things around the game that I could, but I did try out my sophomore, my junior, my senior year, and I never could complete even tryouts. But I remember very well, I think it was Doc Rivers' first year in Orlando, maybe. And he was asked in a presser, probably after the playoff elimination or something toward the end of the season, did you know you always wanted to coach? And he said, I've never gone back to watch this. So at this point, I've probably bastardized and rememorized my bastardization of what he said. But he essentially said, no kid grows up dreaming of wanting to coach. You grow up dreaming of wanting to play. But then when you can't play anymore, coaching is the next best thing, or the equivalent to that is what he had said. And I remember thinking at 15 years old, well, I'm dreaming of coaching, but then at the same time realizing, oh, but that's because I can't play now. I can't play now. So yeah. I'm just a little bit further along that journey at a younger age. My life obviously took a turn. I wound up doing other things and still have this passion for basketball. But I remember that moment so well and how he came to that decision and realizing, well, that's true for me. I'm just a bit younger than he was then. During your, was it 44 years, Jim?
Yeah, I started, a long time ago. Yeah.
Are there one or two inflection moments or watershed moments along those 44 years that were a real before and after for you? And I know we are going to talk about PV and, of course, how your career kind of came to a close. But would just love to hear over those 44 years. I imagine there's a number of moments to choose from, but would just love to hear about one or two.
Yeah, I think one of the great experiences of my coaching career was the ability to coach my own son. And I know that I know that a lot of coaches will say, oh, please don't coach your son. It puts him in a really bad spot. But I thoroughly enjoyed coaching my son. And I know I was hard on him. I think my wife would tell you, you didn't play him enough.
Sounds like a parent.
We had a rule. He and I had a rule and a deal. And that was that when he got into the car after a practice or a game, we didn't talk hoops. We didn't talk basketball at all. We talked about everything else because once we got in the car, we were father and son. And the fact that when Jimmy graduated and he became, you know, we won three straight league championships during his time there.
Wow.
And he was a good player for us and then went on to play at Dickinson College at the Division III level because he, thank God, he got his brains from his mother and he was a really good student. I said to him, I said, you know, maybe this was selfish on my part, but I really enjoyed having you play. And he said, Dad, I wouldn't have had it anywhere else. Mm. And because we had given him an option, he could go to another school if he wanted to, but he just said, no, I wanted to be here. And now he's coaching at Temple University and he's a much better coach than his old man. I know that for sure.
Why do you say that? Other than just being his dad, what makes you say that as a coach?
I think Jimmy was like a sieve. He's one of those kids that just goes out there and he really pays attention and he processes things. And I think that when I was going to retire, Germantown Academy went after him really hard to try to recruit him. He was at that point he was an assistant at Lafayette College in Easton, and Jimmy just said that he said no. And I said the high school thing was my dad's thing. And he said, I don't want to replace my dad. I want to kind of go out and do my own thing. And that was, you know, for a kid at that point, he was only 24 years old, but he showed great maturity there. And I've watched him coach now at Lafayette and at Temple. And I've seen him deal with the people that surround your program. Mm. And I think the thing that I'm most proud of is that whenever my wife and I would go to Lafayette or to Temple to watch him coach, when we would walk in the building, And we would meet like the people like this, the scorekeepers or the managers or the guys that were cleaning up and everything. They all knew him and all spoke extremely high of him, which said to me that, you know, he goes into a situation and he treats everybody with respect.
Right.
And so I'm really proud about that.
That's a great story. Oh, I have some dogs in the background who apparently have an opinion. So listeners, forgive any background from the dogs. They're getting excited by Jim's stories here.
Patrick, I've been booed by the best, so, you know, the dogs don't bother me.
Yeah, I'm sure you've gotten used to a fair amount of background noise over the time. So as I mentioned in the introduction and very briefly a moment ago, Jim is here to talk about polycythemia vera, or PV. It is a rare blood cancer. Last month, September, was Rare Blood Cancer Awareness Month. And Jim's participating in this cool educational initiative sponsored by Insight called Rare Reflections, MPNs Unmasked. MPNs stands for I'm going to get this wrong. Actually, Jim, why don't you say it? You probably have more experience than I do.
Patrick, I'm going straight with I'm going with MPN.
Going right to the acronym as well.
I'm going right to MPN.
I'm going to give it one more shot. Myeloproliferative neoplasms. But MPN is all you need to remember. And Voices of MPN, Mary Patrick Nancy. .com/ rare reflections will get you where you need to go. There's also some great illustrations, portraits by an artist named JG Jones. He's a renowned comic book artist and an MPN patient for over a decade, and he uses art to bring to life these stories of real individuals. There's a beautiful piece of Jim in his element coaching, as he did for those 44 years. So Jim, why don't we talk now about PV? What is it, and how did you learn that you had it?
Well, it's a progressive rare form of blood cancer. And there's several different types. And for me, my story is one of ignoring symptoms, which I would recommend people not do at all. I was a high school coach, a history teacher, and the director of athletics at a high school outside of Philadelphia in Germantown Academy. And I guess for probably about a year, I had migraine headaches every single day, and I thought it was I thought it was part of the job description of being an athletic director. And so I just kept ignoring it. At the same time, I was also teaching constitutional law, which I love to do. And one day in, I guess it was 2012, in January of 2012, I was teaching the class and in constitutional law, and luckily, my daughter, Erin Elizabeth, was in that class, and it was a senior class, a senior elective, some of the greatest kids, and Erin was in there, and all of a sudden, I went totally numb on my right side, from my face, my right arm, and my right leg, but like a thick-headed Irish Catholic kid, I continued to teach, but my daughter realized that there was something wrong, and there was another teacher who was mentoring, who was basically I was mentoring in the room, and they both noticed like something was wrong with Jim. And so my daughter broke all the school rules because she immediately texted the school nurse. And by the end of the class, my leg came back, but my right arm and my face did not. And so I walked down to my office, and when I got down there, the school nurse and a whole bunch of people were there waiting for me, and they took my blood pressure and said, "It's off the charts. You need to go immediately to the ER. And I said, no, I have a game today. And I fought them for about all 5 minutes until my associate athletic director, she said, "Well, now you don't have a game. I just canceled it. You're going to the hospital." And when I got there, I got into the ER, and the doctor said, "Well, you didn't have a stroke and you didn't have a heart attack, but we can't seem to get any blood out of your arm." And I thought, like, I know I'm a spaz, but how do you break the blood in your arm? My wife was there at that point, and they said, "Well, but there's a specialist upstairs that's teaching doctors about rare blood disorders. Do you mind?" And my wife said, "Yeah, get him down here." And he knew right away. It was my blood count was 19.8, which the doctor said, like, "Jim, we have to get your blood out of you. So we're gonna do that. You have a thing called polycythemia vera." And I didn't know what it was. And I actually didn't actually know the severity of it either. But they took them 4.5 hours to get 500 cc's of blood out of me.
Jeez.
Because my blood was so thick. And then the doctor said, you know, normally it's a very misdiagnosed type of disease. And he said, if you had gone to that game, you probably would have died on the court.
Wow.
And everybody would have said you had a stroke or a heart attack. And he said, but in reality, what you had is P. vera. So it was a form of blood cancer. In my case, even with that, you know, I missed the, well, they didn't play the game. And then the next, they kept me in the hospital from Tuesday to Friday. And because it's a rare disease, insurance doesn't always cover everything at that point. They do now, which is good. So Friday night, they released me. And Friday night, it was supposed to be the night when my team won my 500th career win for me. My son, who was playing basketball at Dickinson College, came home. His coach brought him home, and he babysat me as my daughter and my wife went to the game because my daughter was a scorekeeper. And we won. Well, my assistant coach did a great job, and the kids won the 500th game, my 500th career, and a whole bunch of newspapers were calling and everything. And then the next day was senior day, and I convinced everybody in my household that I would go to that game the next day, and I promised that I would not coach, and I would sit on the sidelines, and I was lying through my teeth.
Did you know at the time that you were lying?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was like, okay, well, I went to the hospital, and, you know, they took care of it. I'm good now. Let's go.
Right.
And so I went to the game. And my wife and my daughter were there, and my son was back. He had a game that day, but all the people in school were there. And I honestly did sit there for the first three quarters, but my team wasn't playing the way I thought they should play. And the fourth quarter, there was up coaching, and the kids went up winning, and they played great. And everybody said, like, Jim, you know, you don't look good. And I said, no, I never did look good, but, you know, whatever. Well, the next morning, Jimmy's college coach brought him home right after his game. I think they had played at Franklin and Marshall, so he brought him back home. And the whole family went to church, and while we were at church, the exact same thing happened. I went completely numb. Hmm. And so my family just took a look at me, and I just said, I can't move. And so immediately, boom, right back to the hospital. And that's when I kind of realized how severe this was, because I saw the faces of my family.
Yeah.
And they were really, really scared. And I said, you know, this is something not to mess with. When I got to the ER, my wife called the oncologist, hematologist, who had seen me. And he came in and gave me kind of like the fact of life discussion, saying, this isn't a game. This is life or death. This is serious what you have. It's rare. It's progressive. It gets worse. He said, we've got to take care of it. And so I wasn't able to coach or teach for the rest of that year. But I got the message, and then I started doing exactly what I was supposed to do, which was basically listen to the docs, do what they told me to do, take the right medicines, exercise. I walked between 5 to 6 miles every day. And then I was able to go back, and I was able to coach while getting my blood checked and everything else for 7 more years. And then in 2019, I announced that, you know, I was 68 years old, and I kind of felt like I really wanted to watch my kid coach. And I felt tired. And I said, like, you know, I know I got this thing, but I think, you know, I think it's just time for me to stop, because I had coached for 40 plus years. And so the school didn't want me to retire, which was very flattering for me. but I said, they said, please don't announce it until after your season's over. And I said, well, okay. Well, in January, I just knew I was really tired. And so I said, listen, you know, we have a new AD. Just announce this and get it over. I said, my guys will still play hard, and they would. And so they announced it, and there was a lot of hubbub, you know, because I was fortunate. We had won a whole bunch of championships, and I had really good players, and they always made me look good. and so that evening, my son came home from coaching, and he just said, like, I thought you'd be upset about giving up coaching. I said, nah. I said, you know, I think it's time for me to do something else. And So that evening, my wife and I were asleep. I woke up around 11 o'clock, and I just felt like I had really bad indigestion. So I started walking around the house, trying not to wake up my wife. And then around 2 o'clock, I said, I think I have to go to the hospital. So when I went, they said, well, you know, we know you have P. Vera, mm-hmm. but did you know you have pneumonia?
Oh, God.
And do you know you have a major heart attack? And I said, no, I did not.
Wow.
So at that point, that was the end of my coaching career. I was able to teach a little bit when I got back, about, I guess, about 8 or 9 weeks after that. But, you know, I was blessed. I was fortunate. And it P. Vera is one of those diseases that does not need to define you, but you need to pay attention to your body. Mm-hmm. And you need to listen to your doctors, and you need to like be not so egotistical to think that you can just handle everything yourself, because coaches have a tendency to think that way. And
sure, yeah,
I was definitely thinking that way. And then the good Lord and basically said, no, Jim, you can't control this. You got to do what you're supposed to. And so, you know, for the last year and a half, I've been retired. I do a lot of volunteer work for Coaches Versus Cancer. And Road to Recovery, driving people to their chemo treatment. But obviously with the pandemic, I haven't been able to do that. So
sure.
I'm hoping to get back to that soon. But it's I gave you a long story there, Patrick.
What a story, Jim. What a story.
Basically, it's a disease that people have to pay attention to, and hardly anybody knows it. The symptoms can be the headaches, can be dizziness, can be night sweats, a lot of different things. And when I look back, I had all that stuff and I just ignored it and just said, oh, it's just stress, but it wasn't.
Are those amongst the most common symptoms, Jim, night sweats and headache, just for people, cause it is so rare. What are the most common symptoms?
Yeah, I think for me, it was really like the headaches, the fatigue. I never really had that much dizziness, although some people would say, well, you coached for 40 years, you must have been dizzy, and you're probably right.
Sure.
But I did have the night sweats, and I did have the itching. I had the whole thing, and when the first time when the oncologist, hematologist kind of looked at me and said, like, you just gave us a complete definition of the symptoms of P. Vera, and you didn't think to go to see a doctor. And I said, I had a game. And so that was just how I was thinking, and I was just ignoring everything. And it would not have been a good thing for me to drop dead on the court when my daughter was the scorekeeper, and my players were out there, and my players are kind of like my family. So I that would not have been a good thing, and I should have paid attention. But I'm extremely lucky. I'm extremely fortunate. And you can live your life but you have to take care of things, and you have to listen. And I think that was the key thing for me. And I've been blessed to be around all these people with, you know, the Rare Reflections for the P. Vera and for the MPM website. And I think it's one of those things. It's one of those diseases that I'm sure people have, but just don't know about it.
Yeah, it sounds
so
like
I'm thrilled to be able to, whatever help I can be to get the word out.
What has it been like to be a part of the Rare Reflections project? What has it meant to you?
I have said this to the people there. I have been blessed. They're remarkable people, and so professional, but yet so caring, that they understood that, you know, hey, you want to be active and you have this disease, so let's try to help you get to that point. And so the Rare Reflection thing, I said to the artist, the graphic artist, that, you know, he did the impossible. He actually made me look good, which was extremely difficult to do. But my grandson is he loved the illustration, and he's only 2 years old, and
cool.
Now he has a rough copy of it, just I think on his little laptop or whatever he's got. And every time he runs by it, he just yells, "Papo, there he is." So he knows his grandfather was at least a basketball coach.
Well,
but,
yeah.
I just think they're remarkable people, and I'm just blessed. And the fact that the medicines that I get that have been created, you know, if I had gotten this 10 or 15 years ago, I'm probably not here right now. So it's remarkable what they're doing.
Well, I should ask you, Jim, how are you? You know, you mentioned earlier it is a progressive form of cancer. How are you? So what has it been now? 7, 8 years? When was your diagnosis and how are you doing now?
It was in January of 2012. My daughter became a nurse and she is a neonatal intensive care nurse at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is a great one. And I think she became a nurse because of that experience, to be honest, because she pretty much saved my life. But then she became that sweet little girl who my wife and I absolutely adore, became the taskmaster. She is watching me what I eat. I'm afraid that one of these days I'm going to have to eat the front lawn. But it's she's got me on a plant-based diet, and I walk 5 to 6 miles every single day.
Excellent.
So I've lost the weight. I feel strong. There are days when I know I have PVERA because I get fatigued a little bit sooner than I thought. But in all honesty, I feel great. I feel like I'm listening to my docs, and I'm hoping that I can still do some things to help other people, which I was always. I was always reticent to retire because I felt like, well, what do I do then?
Right.
But I have, you know, the people from Insight, the people from the Coaches versus Cancer have given me this whole basketball coach an opportunity to help other people. And so I'm really, really appreciative of that.
What a story. So voicesofmpn.com is where you can go to learn more, to hear more of Jim's story. There's a great mini documentary as well that's been done in his story. I'll have a link to that in the program notes and the stories of others who are living with these rare cancers. Again, September being Blood Cancer Awareness Month. Jim, I could talk to you about so much of what you said for so long, but one thing I do want to ask, or I don't even know if there's a question in here, but as a means of, I suppose, wrapping up, there was something that you said in the mini doc that struck me, and I might be reading into it a little bit. You'll tell me in a moment. There was a way that you had just phrased your being a high school coach, and you said something about getting to sleep at home at night and getting to be with the family. And as we've talked for the last 25 minutes, you mentioned getting to coach your son. When I asked you about a career highlight, you talked about your son. You talked about the lucky fortune of your daughter being in the class the day of a medical emergency, and now she's a neonatal intensive care nurse at CHOP, of all places. So I guess where I'm going with this is what role has your family played in your life as a coach, in your life now as a patient, and I guess all throughout the 44 years and year and a half since retirement?
Well, Patrick, I may choke up on this one, but my father, who was deceased now, and my mother, they always taught our family to, whenever you deal with adversity, there's two paths you can choose. One is hope and one is fear. And he just always said, we choose hope. My family has been my savior.
Yeah.
They've done, they yell at me when I needed to be yelled at. But they've loved me straight through everything. Sorry. It's hard for me to talk about them.
No apology necessary. That says everything. It's amazing. Your story is amazing. Your career is incredible. Your family sounds extraordinary. Your daughter, in the moment that she's in the mini doc, I can only imagine how proud you must be. And she seems nice, at least for like a drill sergeant keeping you on task. She at least seems like a nice person to be doing that. It could be worse. You know, they just released that movie about Miss Ratchet from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So we know it could be worse. But
well, Patrick, thank God she takes after her mother. thank God she takes after Mary. That's all I can say.
I recognize the self-deprecation. You know, you mentioned earlier being, a thick-headed Irishman. As Patrick James Lynch and a junior at that, the humor and the disposition resonate. Jim, thanks for coming on. Thanks for sharing so openly with me. The work you're doing is really important. I think you know that, but it bears repeating. And I think people who are in athletics, especially being able to talk about what it means to listen to your body, not try to be too tough, not try to grit it out, and your willingness to share mistakes that you made and symptoms that were there and not paying attention. It's so important. So I'm really happy to know you and to know that you're doing this work. And I want to encourage everybody who's listening, go to voicesofmpn.com to learn more about Jim and people like Jim who are living life to the fullest in spite of their rare blood cancer. Jim, have a great rest of your day. And maybe next time I'm in Philly, if we ever get to travel again, I would love to look you up and maybe go out for something or other.
Patrick, please do that. And listen, take care of yourself. But thank you for the great opportunity.
You're most welcome. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, again for participating. Visit voicesofmpn.com to learn more about Jim's story and the stories of other people living with rare blood cancers. Amy, I hate to say it, but we've reached that time of the podcast once again where it's time to wrap up.
It's time to wrap up. Everybody remember to vote. I know it's stressful. It's a big deal. Find out your deadlines. Do your due diligence. Go to vote.org and you will be all set. You will figure it out. You'll be so smart and then you can post about it on social media and your celebrities will not be bummed or disappointed in you. And that's what's important. So vote. No, that's,
yeah, if that's not motivating, I don't know what will be. And with that, that is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Bloodstream Media and Believe Limited who make this podcast possible. Thanks to our presenting sponsor, Takeda, bleedingdisorders.com, to learn more about their work. And thanks as well to Jim Fennerty, voicesofmpn.com, to learn more. And to Nord's Lisa Safferty, register to attend the Rare Impact Awards for free by visiting rarediseases.org or following the links in the program notes. Reminder to subscribe to the Bloodstream Podcast wherever you listen. Leave us a rating in the Apple Store. Share this episode with a friend. Word of mouth is the best way we reach new people. Do you have a topic that you would like to hear us discuss? Want to share your bleeding disorder story on the pod? Email us, mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You can connect with Bloodstream Media on social media. You'll find Bloodstream Media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Or you can follow Amy and me. We're findable in all the places.
We are.
Reminder to check out the show notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find the links and information related to the segments and stories featured on this episode. I'm your host, Patrick James Lynch, alongside co-host
Amy Board.
And until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody, and vote.
Bye.